KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Paul Laffoley. Good evening, everybody. Hello there. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's good to be with you tonight. Really quickly here, let's do a thank you to Debbie Johnson. Wonderful stuff, as always. Free Range Radio Theater, 1 hour before this program. Before her, Kelvin and Jason, Do It Up. Jazz plus blues equals true enough. Tech Radio, informative as always. Jeff Wheeler starts things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Great music and talk and news. Killer Radio here on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be here with you and a part of it all tonight. Okay, thanks to everyone who listened and participated last week. I enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. No guests last week, but I took the chance to get a few things crossed off my own list. Did that, and also heard the music of Mark Kozelek and one of his recent projects called Sun Kill Moon. super talented guy. Some of my favorite new music. If you miss the show, it's all on the web, www.mikehagan.com. And in the program archives, just click on the program archives and you'll be able to check out everything we've done in the past year, okay? All right, tonight, the amazing Paul Laffoley, a brilliant painter, visionary in his subject matter for sure, the coolest architect I've ever seen. He was on the program a few months ago, back in February, and a lot of folks wanted to hear him talk again. I did as well, so we'll do that in just a few minutes. Paul Laffoley on the web, if you want to get a leg up at his website, you can check it out at www.laffoley.com. And you'll get a taste of what I'm talking about. He has another website, Laffoley Archive, L-A-F-F-O-L-E-Y, archive.com. You can see some wonderful stuff at either one of those places. And you can link over there from my site, from the archives, from the last program that we did together, or from the front page this evening. Okay? All right. If you do that and go over to Laffoley.com, you can see some of the concepts and ideas and images that we'll be talking about with Paul in just a few minutes here. Also returning tonight, our musical guests, the Bastard Fairies, a favorite band of mine that I've come across in the last little while. We started things off there with a song called Everyone Has a Secret from their recent release, Memento Mori. More from the Fairies throughout the show tonight with Paul. And I'd like to clarify something really quickly about the music I play on the show. First of all, I only play independent music, artists that are sharing their music with other people and doing it without the shackles of restricting copyright laws and this sort of thing. And I look for music that I like. And as with all art, you know, there may be some of it that you like and there may be some of it that you don't like. The same goes for the interviews and such, for the program, for that matter. You know, some of you will like it, some of it perhaps you won't like. But please understand that I have, you know, reasons for playing what I play. Whether you agree with the reasons or not, or dislike the music or whatever, that's, you know, it's a personal preference thing. It's an art thing. Absolutely. You know, some stuff you like, some stuff you don't. The Bastard Fairies, I've taken a whole bunch of crap from people who somehow think that they know better than I do about which music is appropriate for which of my guests and this sort of thing. Well, that's my business, okay? And if you happen to not like it, you can always turn something else on during the break. You can put on your own music. There's plenty of opportunity to know that a break is coming. You know, you can go outside and look at the stars. You can turn on another show and listen to them peddle some of their wares or whatever they do. And, you know, it's all right. But get off my back about it, all right? I try to play stuff that is original and from artists whose work I think is good. When it comes to originality and being independent, you can't get much more so than the Fairies. I mean, anybody who can get Bill O'Reilly as riled up as that lovely young lady did, you know, you got to dig them. So, anyway, the Bastard Fairies tonight with Paul Laffoley, like it or not. All right, regardless, you can find info about all the music I feature on the program on the web at my site in the music archives. So, there it is, and it'll be there, okay? Great stuff coming up. Stay in tune. One more minute for me here. We'll get things all put together. We'll come back in just a couple, 3 minutes with the amazing Paul Laffoley. Okay, one more here quickly from the Bastard Fairies themselves. This one's called A Heathen's Lament. Back in just a few minutes, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. We'll have Paul Laffoley for the next few hours.
Sometimes my walls just crumble at your feet, but my kind of tears you refuse to see. And I know my pain it's time.
Heathen's Lament. All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. Our guest tonight is Paul Laffoley. He's an architect, a master painter, a visionary futurist with some great maps and diagrams for a future much more appealing to me than the options I'm seeing from some of the other purveyors of that sort of thing. As I always say, may the best story win, and Paul Laffoley has some great stories. We're going to talk about some of them tonight. So here with us tonight from his studio in Boston, Massachusetts, the remarkable Paul Laffoley. Paul, welcome back to Radio Orbit.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
As always, an honor. Thank you.
Oh, before we begin, I have a question.
You do?
Like about 20 years ago, mm-hmm. I did 8 paintings on Elvis.
Elvis Presley.
Elvis Presley, yeah, uh-huh. Right. And the guys never showed them, but now he's showing some interest. And I heard, just in passing, that there was a singer named Elvis Hitler. So where could I get some information on him and get CDs and stuff like that? Because I was thinking of putting that in the background to the show.
Elvis Hitler, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but I'll bet you the people that are listening will find out, and we'll know in a matter of minutes.
I need the band and how to contact them, you know, and that kind of stuff.
No problem. We'll figure it out, and I'll get it to you, okay?
Great.
Okay. All right. Let's see. All right. We got a list of things here that we'd like to talk about tonight, Paul. You were on the program back in February, so people can reference that for further background if they'd like to. But tonight, I think I'd like to start just by asking you a little bit about what you've been up to for the last few months. 3 months can be sort of a long time these days. So anything interesting you'd like to tell us about that's been happening in the meantime?
Well, last week I was at the Folk Art Museum in New York giving a lecture on the intentionality of oneness. I was supposed to have this lecture done it couldn't go past 20 minutes, and I was completely freaked out, and I have a defibrillator, so I figured the thing was going to go off, and the person that was running it, the curator, was sitting in the front row, and she said, you better stop at that time. It turned out that I had to throw my lecture out, and I just ad-libbed the thing, and I came out to the exact second of 20 minutes.
What is the intentionality of oneness about?
Well, it's the idea that it's like Plotinus. You know, I took several people as the image. You know, I took Wendell Willkie first. He was a person who died in 1944, and he was the Republican candidate against Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the election of that year.
Uh-huh.
And in 1943, he wrote his magnum opus, which was One World. So he did everything that people think about now in this one book. If you go 28 years later to John Lennon singing Imagine,
mm-hmm.
all the stuff that was in that song was in this guy's book.
One World.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And so then I worked it back to Plotinus, who, you know, basically said there was only one thing. You know, he lived, you know, between about 225 and 274 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
He was the only person that could be literally defined as a Neoplatonic philosopher, you know, where philosophy and religion finally united,
yes,
you know, rather than remain separate.
Right, right.
And what his position was, there was one knower, and that which is known in a mutually interdependent relationship. I mean, of course, we now accept that, but he figured out how it could actually occur. And so I made a painting that modeled that. And if you can imagine, like a sphere in the center of something, and then inside the sphere is a motif, something that would vacillate in relation in all directions. It would occupy all the radii of a sphere, not all at once, but separately. And what it would do, it would like if the sphere was a rubber sheet and you pushed in one direction outward, then it would cause a you know, like a topological change in the shape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you got this thing going from the center so that it went above the speed of light, you would then have something that would know itself. Because the whole point of something where there's oneness, it wants to know itself. And so how does it do it? So you usually you think of God as something that doesn't have a need to know, and yet that was the whole point, that he was saying that God did. And so when you had next to you, like you said, the next radii over, you would not only know a particular form of knowledge at some point, but you would be aware of the next one coming up beside you. But it would happen so fast that when you were aware of something else, you were alive and everything else was dead. And then when something near to you went up first, it would be alive and everything else was dead. So it remained a condition of that there was one knower in that which is known in a mutually interdependent relationship, and there's no other there was no other thing, and so it would know itself. That's basically the thing in a nutshell.
And you had 20 minutes to describe this and explain it to people. And,
right.
And you nailed it right on 20 minutes because you had a timer that they were going to bust.
No, I don't know why it happened. Somebody, my I guess your health proxy. I had a health proxy there who was timing me. And she said when I got through that I did it exactly for 20 minutes. But I simply just threw away the lecture, which would be like 2 hours or something like that if I read it.
Oh, when you said you had a defibrillator, this was you were being serious, and this was
no. I have a combination of pacemaker and defibrillator.
All right.
Because a while back I had my heart removed. You know, I was in a medical coma for 4 hours. And the surgeon took the heart out. I mean, she was a woman. She held it up. It was an operating theater. So she said she was like a Mayan queen holding up a live heart.
I can picture it. Oh my gosh. Okay, so she put you back together though.
Oh yeah. No, I feel great.
Yeah, I mean, you have so many of these amazing stories, and many of them are like physically like traumatic stories, which sort of, okay, let's move on a little bit, okay?
Okay.
The next thing. Okay, I want to ask you a question about your memory.
All right.
I mean, how good a memory do you have?
I mean,
do you know. Do you really have like a photographic memory?
I'm not sure. I remember as a kid, you know, having to memorize words for spelling bees.
Uh-huh.
That the side that got me would capitulate. I said, we're going to lose by 1 point because I would always miss the word. And it was simply because I wasn't interested in spelling. Now of course I am, you know, and I write, I have a dictionary around all the time, and so I've learned to spell simply out of habit. But I'm not sure, that, I don't think you can have a memory unless you work with the information.
Hmm.
So this business so my mother had the kind of memory that I think you're talking about. You know, one of these photographic memories where it didn't matter what the subject was.
Mm-hmm.
She could just read a book, and then she said during a test, she could then look at the book and open the page where it was and go down the page and find the answer.
Uh-huh.
But it didn't mean anything to her. She wasn't interested in the material.
Uh-huh. I see.
But I have to work for the information, because whenever I think of something there, I'm usually putting it into a painting.
Mm, I see.
You
okay.
Know?
All right.
So I think that's the kind of memory I get.
All right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Next thing. For the most part tonight, Paul, we'll be talking about the future. All right.
Okay.
But before we get too deeply into that, into the program, there are a couple issues that have come up regarding the past that I'd like to clarify and sort of put to rest before we go further.
Yeah.
Specifically, the last time you were on the air, you made a few comments during our first broadcast, just sort of off the cuff. We were just talking about your background, but you talked a little bit about the World Trade Center and their construction and your involvement and 9/11 and some comments that you had made regarding that stuff generated a considerable amount of anxiety among...
Why?
Well, I don't know. All I know is that I had a lot of people that would ask if I would clarify the business with you. It was a 10-minute segment out of a 3-hour interview, and I got a whole lot of people that were sort of up in arms about it. So for the record, I just want to sort of clarify that stuff for the people who want to get it clarified.
What specifically were they?
All right, specifically, knowledge of the WTC construction project and what you believe happened on 9/11. I want to start, let's just ask, first of all, again, your employment with Emery Roth.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was working for Frederick Kiesler at night.
An amazing architect, if people aren't familiar.
And he said, well, you know, like, you're kind of my apprentice, and I can't pay you much money, so you're going to have to get a day job to be able to live in New York. And so I hunted around, and I finally found this place that accepted me and brought me in and put me directly into the design group. Now, I was amazed, because I went to like 16 other places and said, they asked me, you know, could I do working drawings, could I do this, that, the next thing, and I said no, you know, so I figured I might not even get a job in architecture.
Right. All of a sudden you're in the design group.
Yeah, and it's simply because that was the least desirable part of this company, because this company, in its heyday, was responsible for probably 80 or 90 of those file cabinet office buildings, you know, that are basically rip-offs of Mies van der Rohe buildings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what an architect would do, especially like, you know, like a big-time designer, would come into New York and just take over the company. You know,
and again, this is Emery Roth and Sons we're talking
right,
about.
Emery Roth and Sons, yeah, right.
Right.
And they enjoyed this position, because they were like a huge pencil for a prominent architect. And so here they said they were doing a joint venture with Yamasaki, and he had received the commission in 1958. There was a competition for the building, and he got it. And then, so by about 1962, they started working on it, but nothing was really going on. So I got there, like at the end of 1962, and so they put me on working for plans of floors 15 to 45 in Tower 2. Now that started to become a real problem because. That Yamasaki had never actually had any notion of the inside of the building. He didn't have a sense of the infrastructure. I didn't care, because he had He had two offices. He had one. He came from Seattle. He was a Pacific Rim architect, and but then for this job, he went and got another office across from the building in Chicago with the Sears Tower,
right,
because
right.
that was his major competition at the time. Because when it was finally built, it was about 200 feet taller than his building, but it hadn't been built at that point. So he was making sure that he would have his towers up and be the tallest buildings in the world for some time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so then so he wasn't interested in anything but the exterior envelope.
Right.
So when we discovered that one, you know, people kept saying, "Well, what the hell is going on here? This guy's a loon." he basically threw a job at this company,
uh-huh.
and not realizing that we didn't have the experience. That, in other words, the experience of the company was mainly doing working drawings and, you know, and doing all the detailed stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Given a plan, an interior and exterior design, so it was making the thing work.
Right. In this case, you basically just had the exterior design.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. When he brought in the model, it was the most beautiful model I've ever seen.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It was fabulously done. The only better models now are done with laser beams and a liquid, which produces a plastic model. That can be like one thousandth scale, you know, so that you can you could do the Taj Mahal with all its details and have the thing maybe 3 feet high or something like that.
Wow! Right.
But at this time, the model was like 10 feet tall, so you could see the differences. And one of the differences is one was taller than the other because one represented David and the other represented Nelson Rockefeller, you know, the people that thought about it and then put in a lot of cash and got the whole thing going, you know. So it was a real glory job in terms of what they were doing, but he had no interest in the fact that you had to make all the streets work because you got the PATH train coming from New Jersey and a whole lot of interior things which messed up the appearance of the building. You know, at the bottom, he just had a square, and you had these two long rectilinear solids that went up into the sky, and that was it. and so I started wondering, when I was working on this thing, how he was going to maintain the sense of office landscaping. Because he sold the idea that this would be open space, and then you could move people around. You know, like today, people in offices do that. You know, they have focus group stuff and all
sure,
that kind of
sure,
stuff.
Sure.
This way, what it turned out, because it had three banks of 18 elevators, you literally went back to boiler rooms. You know, where you had rooms along the walls.
Mm-hmm.
You had a corridor, and then you had all the janitor's offices and the toilets and all that kind of stuff in the center with all these elevator banks, and that was it. And so I started to think of ways to help it out, because you literally did not have enough space on a flat to run an office.
Hmm.
And so I said, how about if every fifth level we have a bridge
right.
across, and that's when I was fired from the company for making that as a you know as an idea,
right.
Because everybody in the office thought it would be good, because first of all it would help the structure,
sure,
because you would have to weld the bridges into the four basic column cores in the center. To make it work, and I think that it probably would have kept the building up four more or five more hours from what happened, and they could have gotten all those people out of there. because they could have moved around, you know, inside the structure instead of being, you know, cut off from everything.
Mm.
But anyway, but the thing was that as apparently, you know, because I heard from people that I remember in there, they said that later, as they got moving towards finishing it, which was finished in 1972, that they started to cheat on stuff. They took out asbestos flocking, because that was when OSHA started to come into the picture and say that this, you know, that when you have a lot of asbestos, that this is going to give people asbestosis,
mm-hmm.
and you need that around steel so that it won't melt, because that's literally what happened when these jets hit with all that jet fuel. I mean, burning it at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit in there, that started to melt the thing. And also, I noticed in the structure that he didn't call for a lot of welding, mostly for rivets. Now, rivets are really dangerous in a big building, because those things will collapse like a steel gate, which is another thing that happened. And then the thing that got me was while I was on the boards working on this thing, there were these engineers walking around who were from Saudi Arabia and asking me where can you put, demolition devices? And I said, what the hell are you talking about? The thing is, this is on paper. There's nothing here. You know, we haven't done anything. Why are you worrying about taking it down?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, that's the way people design their stuff now. Haven't you noticed? You know, you go away from New York for 6 months, you come back, and in the same spot is another building. How could you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And so when the things hit and went down, I said, my God, that was the point. I mean, that's why Building 7 went down. It wasn't hit. It was part of the electrical circuit to take the whole thing down. Of course, when they do that in New York, they cover the building with all kinds of tarpaulins, you know, right to the ground.
And they soak everything with water.
Yeah, just soak with water so that you don't have all the dust and all the stuff that happened. Like, you know.
Okay. A couple things. All right. Okay. First of all, Yamasaki's relationship to the Bin Laden gang.
Oh, yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, were they actually involved in the WTC project?
Yeah. Like, see, the thing is that they became his personal contractors, and he met them in Saudi Arabia, because he made his name as a major architectural player.
Yeah, he had all kinds of projects over there.
Yeah, he did airplane hangars,
right,
railroad
right.
stations, schools,
mm-hmm. big,
hospitals,
big projects. Yeah,
you know, in anything that involved large large work, and so he brought them along, because they were just doing junk jobs or something, and so he said, well, if you play along with me and do things exactly the way I want, then you and I can make a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they did, because like I, every time that I've worked with a contractor, no matter what I do, what I draw, the guy will always figure out another way to do it. And then it's got to be torn up. And then he says, "Oh, is that what you meant?" You know, and so that he trained these people so that they knew exactly what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because detailing a building is tough to get the information across. I mean, it looks easy when you see the building up, but there's a whole set of assumptions about what's going on, and each architect tries to do something new, and so the minute you do something new and the person isn't an architect, they don't know what's going on.
Mm. Right. Okay,
yeah.
All right. Okay, so so they were involved in the project. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so they're running around there. The idea of this idea of built-in obsolescence, people want to know details if you can provide any. In other words, is that what you believe happened, that that charges were actually built in.
I think that that's the reason why that they attacked the buildings. This business of this was some kind of symbol of capitalism or something like that. This was a building that they knew because they were involved in building it.
Right.
And so they in 1993 they tried to do something at the lower floors with non-electronic devices or something or other, you know, so that the people wouldn't, you know, like urine-soaked newspapers and all this kind of stuff. And then they blew out about six floors, but it really didn't do any damage because the four main columns, you know, that go right down through the whole building, were huge at the bottom. They were like elephant legs. You know, when you get closer to the top, they were smaller. So they were actually telescopic things that could fold up. That was another part of the structure.
Hmm.
So that you could, it's almost as if you could one day decide to bring the thing flat right to the ground. And if done properly, in other words, without the explosions, you know, when you put explosions in to demolish something, that doesn't mean that you demolish the whole thing. You just take the building down, and oftentimes you want to use some of the parts later.
Hmm.
You know, and here the thing was almost turned into total dust.
Right.
Yeah.
Whew. All right. Well, would they have had the charges built in, or would they have just have known where to put them?
I think that they had to build them in.
Because that's what was going on all around New York, you say.
Yeah, because so that it's something that they don't tell people, because like if a secretary is working in some place and this place is loaded with explosives,
right,
you know, they're going to say, what the hell, I'm not going to work in that place.
Right.
You know, the whole thing was basically very well protected, and it probably had like fail-safe electronic you know, stop gaps or something.
So the question of why they were triggered is still an open question. In other words, or who pulled the trigger, or if the trigger was pulled, or if it was just something that was triggered by the planes.
I think it was due to the planes.
Yeah,
in other words, the planes hit the electrical system that was involved in that.
What about number seven?
I would assume that all of them were connected, you know, to the whole system. Probably some other ones too.
Mm-hmm.
And if you mess around and you short circuit something,
who knows?
You know, and it just happened to do that to the building seven.
Yeah.
So, in other words, it was obviously a plot to do it. But they had a leg up,
right?
A leg up and a half, knowing that if you hit the right spot, you could take the whole thing down in a second, which is basically what they did.
Well, I'll be damned.
It came down very, very fast.
Yeah. Well, okay. I think that we have addressed this as much as we need to, and thank you very much. I want to say one more thing about it. First of all, for me, I really didn't have an agenda about 9/11. I have my own ideas, but as far as what I'm willing to share with anybody else, I think one thing, and that's that the official story is bunk. Other than that, I had no idea, and so this clarifies a lot of things for me.
I can remember when they had all these investigations and they had professors from MIT and talking about stuff and they were trying to stir up some conspiracy business, and I'm saying, why not ask the people who are actually involved in the design? I never heard anything about Emery Roth.
Right.
I never heard anything about Yamasaki.
Me neither.
Yeah.
Well, and this is why I got so much grief, and it's very interesting to me that nobody else is willing to touch this stuff. I mean, it really is interesting. You can't believe what I've been through for the last 3 months about this damn thing. But listen to this, Paul. Let me ask or make one more point with regard to this. You also have a design that you entered as in a competition or whatever it was that they had for what's going to be the next building or buildings that are going to replace the World Trade Center. And I have that image, actually, one of your drawings up on my on the front page of my website, and I'd like everyone to take a look at it, because I'd also like to give you a leg up on a vision, and that is going to be the building that is going to take the place of the World Trade Center. And for some reason, I'm almost certain of it.
I think you could be right, and part of the reason why I chose to do this was that it's a building that was designed by Antonio Gaudi, you know, who lived most of his life in Barcelona and did, you know, the Sagrada Familia, you know, the Casa Batlló, Casa Emilia, all the things that people know about him. But in 1906, he was approached by two entrepreneurs from New York, and they were trying to figure out how to build on made land, you know, because that where Ground Zero is actually part of made land, you know, like you have the Hudson and East River making the inverse of the Delta, because this is where people first, when they came to New York, they came in boats, and they landed and made boat slips in what's now the Battery. And then filled it in with junk, you know,
throw
things overboard, and then people put land in there, you know, and all this kind of stuff, so that it was all soft. It's like stuff in Boston. Almost all of Boston is the result of made land.
Right, it used to be all islands.
Originally, it's a set of like little hills and islands, different places.
Right.
So here was the situation where you had this kind of thing going on in many places in the world, because shoreline land that couldn't support big buildings suddenly became of interest to various groups, because they discovered that you could build on there, and so these two entrepreneurs went over to Barcelona and enticed Gaudi to come up with a huge hotel. It was a grand hotel. Usually you have things that are called grand hotels, but it's just probably a little bit bigger than other hotels.
Mm-hmm.
It's like at the time that they wanted him to build this, the only hotel was the Waldorf, which was in the same position as the Empire State Building is today. Yeah, I mean, it was the first one that worked with Madison Square Garden down, you know, a little bit down south,
right.
You know, where they had the New York 400, you know, and so they'd come up to the Waldorf and allowed the hoi polloi to mingle with them. You know, that's where Nikola Tesla made his money by talking to Westinghouse and J.P. Morgan,
sure, J.P. Morgan, all those gangs. Yeah.
So when Gaudi was considering this, he said, "Okay, I'll try it, because there are several things that would be working in my favor. First is that during the time they were building the Statue of Liberty." A family of tile setters went over to New York and got the job for the base of the Statue of Liberty, and then also they got the job for the interior ceiling of the Oyster Bar in Grand Central Station.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've ever been there,
they have a fantastic
oyster.
Oh yeah, totally
too.
Cool. If you haven't been
there,
right.
Everybody should try that. You know, 20 oysters, big ones, really good. And only in all the years that's been in existence, see, the Grand Central Station was started in 1913. It was actually everything that Saint Elia, you know, the Italian futurist, wanted in connecting, all forms of transportation in a building were all done in Grand Central Station. And then, of course, when Pan Am was built on the top of that, so you had helicopters coming in, so it was literally the whole thing. But anyway, Gaudi could see that there were, that America was really going to do a lot of stuff. Now, the reason why I know this, because when I was at Brown University, one of the subjects that I was dealing with was art, you know, and philosophy and stuff.
Sure.
And so I had a course given by William Jordy, who is a professor of architectural history, who's, you know, who ended up being very, very good in that, and a very important person. And so he was writing, when I was there, he was writing or having about 800 pages of notes on every building that was built in the United States from 1900 on up to when he published it, which was in about 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people in the class would ask him, you know, who he was including, you know, in some European architects, and then somebody asked him, you know, like, did Gaudi, does he ever do a building? And he said, no, but they plan to have him do a grand hotel. And so I always remembered that, and I said, wait a minute, this is what should go up, because if that building was produced in, you know, it had been there in 1908, the thing never would have come down. Because it's all composed of catenoids, not paraboloids. You know, a catenoid is a natural form. It's like when you hang a chain, you know, from two positions, you have something that's in complete tension all the way through. You freeze it and flip it over, and now you have something in complete compression, which is why most of his models were things that when you saw the model, it looked like it was upside down, you know, where he'd weight different parts with sandbags so he'd get shapes, you know, because mostly what he did were cathedrals, you know, and shapes like that.
Yeah, it has that sort of a look, this design of yours.
Yeah.
There's certainly a cathedral-esque sort of aspect to it.
And during the time, he started to find out where they wanted to do it, and it was very near where Cass Gilbert was considering doing the Woolworth Building, which is across the street from the
I know where it is.
You know, from City Hall in New York, and in a little bit before 1990, I think it was like 1906 or 1907, that he did a small building what became the West Side Drive, you know, in that area, you know, where you had nothing but piers and boat slips and docks and stuff on the Hudson River side. And so he tested the soil as to what to do. And so Gaudi said, hey, I know how to do that stuff. I can do a big building. And what I want to do is a grand hotel that's 1,048 feet tall. And the reason for that number is that this represented the Knights of Malta, that were were actually formed in 1048, and on the island of Malta, the Pope gave them this whole thing. So it's like a group in the Catholic Church that doesn't take any holy orders, but takes orders from the Pope to do certain things, and now what they do, because they still exist, is that they run the real estate business for the Catholic Church.
that's basically what it is anyway, right? A big real estate deal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so they're the ones that actually own the land that's defined as ground zero.
And so
Gaudi said, well, given that, I could probably get away with this. And then also, I know how to make a huge building like that work without sinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was something that people were doing in Italy in the 15th century. You know, they were using bentonite, which is a colloidal clay.
Right, I know what it is. Yeah,
you can put that down in a hole in muck, and it'll hold the sides back, and then you can drop in some concrete, and then, of course, now we have good rebars. You put those in there, and the bentonite floats up because it weighs less than the concrete, and you got a pillar.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start putting those side by side. They're juxtaposed. There's no spaces between them. And then you have what Yamasaki called the bathtub.
Right.
You get a whole thing, and now because like when you look at a cross section of New York, up near St. John the Divine, the granite stonework or the blocks of stone that make up Manhattan are sticking out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But as you come along to the Central Park, and then it gets lower, and then finally when you get on the Canal Street, the thing drops off about 75 feet below, what you think is ground zero or the level grade. And so because there's no rock there, so
right.
that you have to put stuff in it. So what they did is they made this bathtub, and they then after they got all the sides worked out, they pulled all the muck out, and they made a Battery Park City, right in the water. They filled up in between all the piers that were there,
and then
made that. And he figured, this is Gaudi, that if that's built there, in 1908, that would be, his prime building, because it would be bigger than any of his other buildings.
Right,
and he had such a great interest in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He had in it things like, he had positions for the for sculptures of the presidents up to the year 3000.
Amazing.
Now, a lot of people today don't think the United States is going to last, another 20 years or something. What's going on?
Mm-hmm.
But in, anyway, he had that much optimism, and no one can figure out why it didn't happen, because even when he was alive, there was some concern for making him into a saint, which if you read in the Oxford Dictionary of Architecture, when you come to Gaudi, they said in 1998, he was most of all of the groundwork for him to be a saint has been worked out, and he'll be the only architect in history to ever become a saint.
I'll be damned.
And so I was thinking, wow, if I could get this thing up there, that's where they could have the ceremony for it.
Well, I'll tell you what, this for the people who haven't seen it, the design that Paul has done, what he calls the Spiritus, it's an hotel, a spectral hotel, as a matter of fact, he describes it. But it is remarkable, and it's beautiful, and I would love to see it on the skyline of New York, and I have a feeling that we are, Paul, somehow. I don't know why, but I feel it. So, one more thing really quickly, because it came up in email as we've been talking. During 9/11, where were you? I know you had an accident in the hospital.
Oh, yeah, because I was just considering whether I have my leg amputated or not. I was actually back in Boston, and this is my right leg, because I had fallen 20 feet onto a concrete floor. I was on a ladder. It was in one of my shows.
I'm sorry, Paul.
And it was okay,
because
ended up buying a lion's foot to put on there.
That's a great. Okay, hold on. That's break time. We got to take a break. Top of the hour.
Okay.
We'll come back. We'll finish the story about your lion's foot, and then we'll move.
Okay.
Then we'll move along. Okay.
All right.
Paul, you're awesome. Thank you for doing that. I know that took a half hour of our time, but it was well worth doing. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, everybody. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. Straight up midnight. Now on the 22nd of May, 5/22/2007. And we've got the wonderful Paul Laffley with us for the next couple of hours. We also have some wonderful music from a band called the Bastard Fairies. This is a song called, appropriately, A Venomous Tale. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Paul Laffley. Venomous Tale, that's another tune from Memento Mori, the most recent release from the Bastard Fairies. It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. Our guest this evening is Paul Laffley. We'll get right back to Mr. Laffley here in Boston. You at your place in Boston tonight, Paul?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
I try to spend as much time as I can here.
Well, I know you do, and I know that you pretty much have been painting and doing this stuff nonstop for 40-some years now.
Yeah.
So, your lion's foot, it's a great story, so why don't you finish that off real quick?
Oh, well, as you were saying, that I was in my other studio that I got evicted from. That was in Bromfield Street in Boston.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned it last time you were on the air, yeah.
Yeah, it was there for 38 years. And they finally discovered that I was living there illegally.
They're pretty sharp, you know.
I know. But anyway... while I was there, I came back from New York thinking that I could save my leg, and it started to get sores and everything on it and become necrotic and that kind of stuff. And so when one day the visiting nurse came in, and I had the TV on, and we sat there stunned, watching the World Trade Center get hit by planes. And that's the point at which I got the idea of like, you know, to go behind history and come back and do what Gaudi would have done, you know, and have that there.
Right.
Okay, but then at a few months later, I went over to the MGH and I said, how's the chances of saving my leg? So he took a look at it and said, well, I'll give you an 85% chance of doing that. But it'll require 5 major operations.
Oh, man.
When you have that many operations, one of them's bound to fail statistically.
Right.
And then I'm going to have to cut it off at your hip. And I said, okay, you better do it now.
Mm.
Okay. So then when I came out of that, you know, like they line you up with a lot of psychiatrists and everything, you know, to figure how you're dealing with the thing. And I said, I think you guys better move on because obviously I'm happier than you are.
Yeah. And, I just put a story up on my website a little bit earlier today about psychiatry. Are they actually helping people or not? Basically, it's what it's about.
No, they're just making money off of people for no reason at all. Like, I happen to know the person that writes Paranoia magazine.
Uh-huh.
So I was at the Beth Israel. Yeah,
that's the hospital. Yeah, Beth Israel.
Yeah,
okay.
Beth Israel Deacon's Hospital.
Where is it at?
It's in Boston.
Oh,
you know,
okay. Right.
Like, because this guy that I had wanted to cut both my legs off. and I said, why? And he says, well, just to be in the safe side. and then I said, the safe side of what? So it just went on, and finally he got frustrated and walked out of the room. And then he brought in a psychiatrist who started to work on me. And what he was trying to do is saying that I, you know, to try to make a case that I was mentally incompetent, and so he could bypass my objections to having both legs amputated. And so I happen to be reading a copy of Paranoia magazine. I know the people that run that, and he was starting to say, he said, I think you're schizophrenic and you're probably paranoid too. And I said, yeah. And as I used this as my personal manual, I whipped out the magazine. And so he goes off for 2 hours and reads the whole thing. And, you know, I mean, so he realized that there was something going on that he couldn't control. And so I said, I'm just getting the hell out of here. And so I'm back in my studio, you know, trying to save my leg and, you know, and this kind of stuff. And, you know, it went on and on. And finally, I said, listen, just chop it off. And so after a while, you know, I didn't like things like the color that they use in prosthetics. You know, it was like people wearing racist legs, you know, because it's like an attempt to imitate white skin, and it really isn't.
Uh-huh.
So I got a prosthetic that was black. You know, just like so it looked more mechanical. You know, I removed all of the things that were, you know, that made it look like a leg and a stocking. You know, and all the crap that they put on those things. And then after a while, I said, wait a minute. Since I'm a Leo in astrology, why can't I get a lion's foot? So I happened to go to California, to L.A., because I got an artist in residence at UCLA in Santa Ana, and I went and visited Stan Winston, who does FX for science fiction movies, and I said, can you fix me up with a right front lion's paw, because it has the same shape as a human foot, you know, like at a right angle, you know, because what they have to do is to be able to stand there and then take a big bite out of the side of the passing zebra, you know, so they're not like a gazelle where they're just jumping on tiptoes.
Right, they're sort of flat-footed, really,
right.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And so the guy says, no problem. So he made up, he didn't take a real lion's foot, he made a fake one, and so the... So I wear that at openings and stuff like that.
That's classic. Okay. All right. All right, let's see here. Okay, a lot of people ask. I want to read something really, really quickly, actually.
Okay.
You wrote a great piece that's called The Lecture on the Occasion of Man at I think it was called the Sputnik Conference. This was back
in 2001. Yeah, that was the people like Brian Greene were there and, you know, and Jaron Lanier, you know.
Yeah, I want to. I'd like to ask you a little bit about that because I want to talk about Buckminster Fuller and this whole idea of the Kairos point, and you sort of addressed that in this piece or this lecture that you did there, and you mentioned Fuller's book, Utopia or Oblivion.
Oblivion, yeah, right.
And I'd like you to mention something about what I'm going to read right now. There's a small section here that says. There have been, however, a few groups of futurists who over the past 30-some years have heeded Fuller's message and have attempted to converge on as many aspects of human knowledge as possible within their limits. The goal of our present endeavor is to produce a transdisciplinary worldview which will sustain human existence into a continuous future. This, of course, was the basic message of Fuller's book. Maybe we could sort of use that as a jump-off point for where we are. I'd like to hear your sort of ideas and position about where we are sort of as a planetary culture right now, and then some of the ideas that you put forth in that particular piece.
Well, okay. I remember hearing Fuller several times. You know, that's where he learned to talk, because he would do lectures for 4 hours.
He was
so
amazing.
So now I'm up to doing them for 6 hours.
He went to my alma mater. We both went to SIU in Carbondale, Illinois.
Yeah, but he tried to get through Harvard twice or something, and he flunked out for basically fooling around.
Sound familiar?
Right. And but anyway, so I actually cornered him in Florence. I used to be the director or the Secretary General of the Boston-Cambridge chapter of the World Future Society.
Uh-huh.
And so every once in a while we have these retreats, and the guy that was running that one always had them in Florence at Forza Belvedere. You know, it overlooks Florence, so it's really great to be there.
In Italy. It's an amazing place, yeah.
And also, it's very near the tower that Galileo had when he was exiled there.
Huh.
And what we were trying to do is see if we could buy it, because it was up for sale.
Huh.
The Italians don't like it, because this guy was there as a punishment. So it would be like buying a prison in some area, you know. And so they think that was fine, and it never happened, because they always wanted a hell of a lot of money when they heard Americans were trying to buy the building. But the whole point was the idea that we could keep having our planning retreats there every year, you know, that kind of stuff. But anyway, so we're in the hotel, and then in the middle of one night, he couldn't sleep, and either could I, and so I started talking to him. And saying that, you know, I started off with things like, I said, your geodesic spheres get stronger as they get bigger. And I said, well, can we make them so that they surround the Earth? And he said, yeah. I said, what are you talking about? And I said that I'd like to demonstrate that you can build one of these so that its diameter is like 12 miles above the surface of the Earth all around, and a double layer. And
what's the radius of the Earth? About 3,000 miles or something like that? What's the
circuit? No, 8.
8,000. So it's 16,000 mile diameter?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, well, no, in other words, the Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter, you know, so this would
be. So it's about a 4,000, from the center of the Earth out to any point, 4,000 miles. Okay,
right there,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, great.
And, you know, like we have, at 24,000 miles up, we have, a geosynchronous orbit,
mm-hmm.
meaning that if you throw something out a window at that, the thing will appear to be staying in the same position because the vector down to the center equals the vector horizontally. You know, things are still being thrown. You know, you see satellites going around.
Right.
They're actually in a free fall, but it's in a position that allows it to have that position.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But anyway, that you can literally build these spheres in parts. In other words, it's not necessary to build the thing all in one day. You simply couldn't do it. So how you do it is that you get enough hardware stores at geostationary orbit in position. So I thought of doing the typical one, which is icosahedral pentagonal dodecahedron, which has 64 nodes, which is plenty. And then with crystalline graphite wire, which is, it turns out, it's made out of fullerons, like buckyballs,
mm-hmm.
where this is the strongest kind of wire, and it will hold up, itself with thousands and thousands of miles plus a payload, so that you can actually start to build this thing from above, not trying to build it from below, because there's no the weight of the sphere would be enormous and it would simply crush the structure.
So it has to be sort of completed to get its
right,
stability.
But, in its but you can drop a part of it down with these wire things from 24,000 miles down to 12 miles, because 12 miles is about the limit of the viable atmosphere for the Earth.
Okay.
I mean, you've collected, that's where all the precious minerals that we've dug out of the ground, you know, are there, and that's the reason why we're having, problems with the weather and all that kind of stuff, because mm-hmm. we finally filled up a whole layer of stuff that should be actually back in the ground.
It's up in the area,
and that's why, say if you take Landsat photos of the Earth, and they do it about every 10 years, the deserts grow bigger. Because it's due to the fact that we're taking vital minerals out of the earth, and they're just floating up there. So I said that would be one thing you could use the thing for. But the point was that you could build it one part at a time, and it wouldn't be necessary to have it all done, as I said, in one day. You, mm-hmm. you couldn't do it. There's got to be places where you stop. And then continue on. So
yeah.
As one country gets their part ready, and then finally it all clicks together. And so then on top of that one, you can then build another one. So one could rotate inside the other.
Hmm.
Now the pylons to the Earth are a little more than elevators.
So the individual pieces are supported by a pylon that goes all the way down to the planet.
No, they're not supported by the pylons. That's the point.
Well, how do you? In other words, it's
because if you took a simple ring of some substance
uh-huh.
and put it around the Earth, it would stay in position like an atmosphere,
right?
Because the gravity is equal.
Uh-huh. Yes, I understand.
So the thing is that what I'm saying is that the sphere around the Earth.
How do the individual parts stay there before it gets put together?
Because they're held up by the crystalline graphite wires.
Oh, these fullerene things.
To a thing that you could call a hardware store in the sky.
Oh, all right. So they're sort of hung from above.
Yeah, right.
All right, I got you.
And the thing is that's starting to happen. You know, like the Japanese want to put hotels up there. You know, and NASA already thought of one part of the idea is that they're going to start to build elevator shafts up.
Mm-hmm.
Up there.
Sure, I've seen those stories.
And so it'll have to be in different sections, because when you build an elevator, you can't have it deviate more than a quarter of an inch, or the cab inside will get stuck. You know, so there's got to be, some really interesting engineering for Otis elevators to come up with to do that one. And but the point is that you can build this from materials that are on Earth, like sand. You know, you do fiberglass stronger than steel, which means that you can you're not blocking out like the sun. You're not blocking out cosmic rays, which are necessary. You know, that's how you get evolution.
Sure.
You know, because they keep hitting the DNA.
Right, mutating
and this kind
genes.
Of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that you could, in a sense, get ready to reclaim the land of the Earth. Because like as the population gets bigger and bigger, like people think, wow. If you had like 18 billion people on the Earth, you'd literally have to raise three continents the size of Africa to support them. You know, for vegetables and different kinds of foodstuffs, and so that here you can have a thing where you can reclaim desert land. And put those minerals back in the ground. So you could undo what the Industrial Revolution did to the Earth. That's why we're basically in trouble now.
Hmm.
And so then the next thing is you can do this to the moon. Now the moon has some atmosphere on it because it does have some gravity.
Yeah, very
thin
atmosphere.
It's 1/6 of the Earth,
right.
But there's not much of it, and so it also has water, and where the water is, it's down 1,000-foot holes in the surface of the moon.
Yeah, bottoms of craters and things like that.
Yeah, because meteors have no problem digging into that stuff. Yeah, I remember what was it, Paul Ehrlich or something, in 1972 on the Johnny Carson show, that they shouldn't have, or it was before that, before 1969. He was saying, "Don't go to the moon because there's so much dust that if you step on it, you go out of sight." Well, that turned out to be not true, but it is, in other words, that the surface isn't that resistant to a good meteor hitting it. The way the way ours is, because we have 12 miles of atmosphere, so what started out as a big meteor comes out to something the size of a football by the time it hits.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so once you do that, and you have the same type of a structure, you can then actually connect the Earth to the Moon with a bridge. And you do that through what are called Lagrange points. Those are positions in space where you have a zero gravity.
Hmm.
And so you would build the discontinuous compression structure that was invented by Kenneth Snelson. Now, Kenneth Snelson was a student of Fuller in 1948 at Black Mountain College. You know, in Asheville, North Carolina.
North Carolina, yeah.
And the thing was that Fuller had no visuals when he was giving his class. He was just all words. And so Kenneth, between his freshman and sophomore year, went back to I guess he came to the Midwest or something, and he actually came up with the world's first discontinuous compression structure. You can see those now. You can Google Kenneth Snelson and see these things that look like pipes and wires, and the compression parts don't touch each other. So the only things that are touching are steel cables. Now what you get is in a sense a beam that does not deflect. So it's perfect as a structure in outer space, and it can go indefinitely in length. And so, but the building of it is the problem. Right. So when you start building from the earth, you start building from the moon, and you aim the pots, and then you go to the Lagrange points, and then you start to build on either side of that, and so you get something that starts to look like an interrupted connected tube.
Right, I understand.
And then so from the ends of those things, you can actually make it connect.
Huh.
And then what happens then is as the moon goes around the Earth, it then rotates the outside spheres, and you're literally creating an electric waterfall that's captive, and you can produce as much energy as you want for the Earth and the Moon, and then I'm telling all this to Fuller, and I said, and then the next thing is that since we're destroying vegetation, I said, how about if we build things or grow things with vegetation, graft buildings together, make a vegetable chimera that you can live in,
mm-hmm.
and then do it around the entire earth, and so the image of it would appear like like a pollen seed, something that is very similar to the kind of geometry that Fuller was coming up with.
Hmm.
And that I'm sure that would work, because what it would do is it would take the oceans and then make them into smaller units that would be inside where you have long vegetative structures, and then you could get down to like individual buildings, like I have a house that's in the form of a Klein bottle that sits on top of a pad of pine trees, and then with ginkgo biloba, you can connect conifer to deciduous trees, fruits to vegetables, and vines and grasses, and so that you can basically connect any form of vegetation to itself if you know all the tricks of grafting and how much you need to do that. I mean, because the ginkgo biloba is the oldest flowering plant on the earth. It's like a tree, and it was saved from extinction by some Chinese monks in the 19th
yeah.
century.
Uh-huh.
Now we use it to help our memory. So I think that we're starting to use it, and then as the memory works better, we're figuring out that's the clue to how to fix the earth up.
Hmm.
Because, in other words, as I said, we have to do something that's as vast and as destructive as the Industrial Revolution was to the earth. I mean, it's literally the rape of the earth, and now to heal the whole thing.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, it has to be something radical. I mean,
yeah. Well, since we have we have the moon, and it's like the moon is like perpetual motion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody has ever known the moon not to go around the earth. So you got something going there, and to be able to utilize that as an energy source would then be a model for how to produce something that produce a system that we could use in other parts of the universe, and increase our real estate, because that's basically what's going on. We're going to have to do something like that on Mars, because living in tin cans up there is going to be awful.
Right.
Because there's nothing there, but it looks again like a desert. It looks exactly like that what we could become. And maybe that the face on Mars and all the rest of that is like a clue as to what happens to the people that were up there.
Mm. Let's talk about this Kairos point or whatever. Yeah. In other words, we're facing a lot of crises on a lot of different levels.
Right. I mean, the Kairos is simply, well, it comes from radical Christianity. You know, it's like once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide, and it goes on forever. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thing. It comes from an idea that the time works in one direction, and so if you blow any part of it, that's when you've destroyed everything. So that you have to make sure that every step along the way is carefully thought out and will lead to something productive, rather than going the other way. So the Kairos point is like recognizing that we only have certain activities that are going to be productive, and a lot of activities that aren't, and the ability to separate those out. So we have the wisdom to know which ones to do. People associate it with 2012 because of the Mayan calendar in that way, and then make an apocalyptic notion. But I think it's better than that. You know, in other words, that
I think so too. I'm much more optimistic than that.
Huh?
I'm much more optimistic than that too. I don't think it's the end of the world.
No. I think the people who talk about the end of the world are ones who want it to happen.
I think
and,
so too.
And are very upset if it doesn't.
I mean,
you always see these religious fanatics, you know, going up on the hill and waiting for it to occur, and then when it doesn't, you know, then they're screwed. You know, they've lost their following. Right.
All right. Well, so the Kairos point. So is it a point in time where there's no turning back? I mean, are we there? Have we passed it? What do you think is happening?
No, I think we're moving towards it, and as I'm saying what I'm talking about as a mega engineering plan is to me the only way to actually deal with it. Because if you don't do something like that, then we're going to keep losing all those minerals are going to go in the air, and then we're going to have more global warming. We're going to have this, that, and the next thing, and people say, well, that's a lot of BS and stuff. But the thing is, it's obvious
something is happening.
That we have more and more deserts, and when you have more and more deserts, you don't have arable land.
Hmm.
You know, you just have only a certain type of vegetation that can grow there, as opposed to, rich loam that you can do crop rotation very close to each other and be able to feed, you know, billions and billions of people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like people are starting to have ideas like that they're going to say, if we have a certain population limit, I said, let's kill a lot of people off, and so we're back to Nazism.
Right.
And I think that's really one possibility that could occur, because most people like fascism as a form of government control, and it's the most popular because you don't have to think, you just give one guy thinks and then everybody follows him, so that that's the easy way to live.
Hmm. Yeah, for a while.
Yeah, right, until you find out that your life isn't worth a dime.
Right. Okay, let's see. A question then sort of related about technology.
Okay.
I have a lot of people that actually ask questions about this to other guests and stuff, but it has to do with the possibility of a symbiotic relationship between human beings, the natural world, and technology. Everybody seems to talk about one or the other. In other words, a lot of people are cheering on the sort of back to the earth thing, but that usually includes a denial and resistance of technology. And then there's the other gang that says, no, forget about nature, we're going to bet it all on the technology. But it seems to me that they need to sort of work together, the technology along with nature. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's what mind physics is all about. You know, the physics of consciousness. And it's a attendant technology, which is called psychotronics, where it's mind-matter in interactive devices. That
you did an didn't you do an exhibition actually called Mind Physics?
Yes, I did. Yeah, right.
All right. Well, let's talk about that, and then
okay.
I should actually we've been talking so straight here for a while that I want to mention the website. I haven't done that in a while. Laffoley.com, LaffoLey.com. You can see much of the artwork that Paul has done over the years, including some of the stuff that we're talking about now, and it is remarkable. Okay, Paul, so at the website, I'm sure they can see this stuff, but at any rate, you had an exhibition back in... Actually, it was earlier this year, actually.
Yeah, January 4th when it started.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Went through, like, the end of February.
Right, at Kent Gallery in New York.
Right, yeah.
Right. Okay, let's talk about mind physics, and maybe you can then relate your artwork to it and how they're connected.
Okay. Well, it's actually a revival of alchemy, which... was the same type of thing that scientists are getting back to that with Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy, meaning that consciousness interacts,
right, and that time and, actually does have something to do with the experiment,
right, and so that you can then most of the devices that have been called psychotronics don't involve, electrical power. It's just simply, if the circuit is complete, it will work. And so it works from human intention.
For people.
In other words, like, this is, you know, why people have called magic, like the intention of the will to do things.
Right.
And then they're saying, well, how can that possibly be? Because they can't see how you move parts around. Well, it's that if you have a mechanical device with no moving parts, then you've got a psychotronic generator.
For people who've never heard the word psychotronic before, what's it mean?
Well, it's a kind of you have to have labels for all kinds of stuff.
Right, you got to have a word for it. Right.
Right. Yeah, and it's something that is able to focus consciousness. And have it act so that your will is focusing your consciousness so that it will do things externally to yourself. You know, I mean, if you take the traditional image of magic, you know, where you say you hold your hand out and suddenly an apple pops into existence from there. That's what we're talking about. And so the phase in part. Are the devices that get close to that are things that actually have already been patented, like T. Gallen Hieronymus in 1945 patented a device which, if you take a picture of a field, it was started in farms, as a thing, like you have infestations in farms, and people wanted to figure out how to get rid of insects that eat all the good stuff. And so he said, well, I've got a device. Yeah, I'll take an aerial view of that, and then he takes a picture of it, and then he takes one of the bugs, and he puts it in what they call a witness coil. You know, so you have a little coil, and then inside the middle of it, you put the bug. Turn the thing on. Next day, all the bugs are dead.
Huh.
Now, there you could say, "Well, how did that happen?" It's because the device is very similar to things that were shown in alchemy books. That the people like Robert Pavlita, who was, I guess, at one time was the head. Of the International Psychotronic Association, I belong to the American one, and he lived on Alchemy Row, you know, in Prague. There's a street where during the Middle Ages, where this was like defined as a heretical thing, you know, to be involved with this, that they had a code, in chimneys, you know, where a certain chimney angled this way, or it had two of them, or higher than the other one.
Uh-huh.
You know, like to the cognoscenti represented what this guy did. You know, so you could go to him and do some of the stuff. Now, it wasn't just that they were trying to make gold, you know, but they also did things that were very similar to you know to atomic experiments.
Hmm.
You know, you've heard of heavy water, you know,
sure.
But you can get heavy water if you take regular water and distill it 30,000 times, because you finally get rid of the light water,
mm.
you know, which will just go off in gas, and so you'll have this water that can do some things that they didn't even know why it worked at that time. But as the atomic structure became more collective, it means that if you stare at it and work your will on it, that it will now be more amenable to change, because the whole point of psychotronics is to figure out how to change materials without any intervening consideration.
Yeah, technology or anything like that.
Yeah, because what it meant is that then technology and morality become one thing.
Hmm.
It's like now, today, like say some guy invents a new hammer and they put it out in a hardware store. Guy comes along, buys a hammer, and he kills his friend with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you can see, well, the person who invented the hammer said, well, you know, that's not my department. I'm not responsible for killing that other person. But you can't say that in psychotronics, because this thing must work totally with the person, so that if the person is bad, you know, like, he's going to know that he did this. It isn't something that he can take something else and then have the have the guilt laid on the person who designed it. He doesn't even realize it's being used that way, and then remove some of the guilt when he uses it. I mean, people do this all the time with guns.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the person who invents the gun thinks it's going to be used for, you know, admiration, you know, and hunting and all this kind of stuff. Where another guy takes that out and he just pops people. And so that kind of separation between the will and the goal and the technology has been fused into one thing in psychotronics, so that it becomes, you know when this thing is dangerous, because if you've ever used one of these devices and you see how it can eliminate insects or birds or something in an area, you're going to be pretty wary of this thing, because you say, well, what, I didn't shoot the birds, you know, they're just gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that kind of thing. So that means that you become closer to nature.
What?
Through the use of something that's mechanical. So in other words, what I think you're talking about is that the bifurcation between technology and nature, as people go in different directions. Well, this is where it brings them together. It doesn't stop technology, nor does it stop morality.
Mm.
It simply brings them together, because that's the bugaboo with extreme technology. Because you see all these science fiction stories about people not recognizing the implications of some of the things that they do,
right.
And so you've got a situation where you suddenly, it's brought to your mind completely what are the ramifications, mm-hmm. and implications of what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
with what you've invented,
mm-hmm.
and so that's actually a lot of what I do as art. You know, it's like I take the instantaneous condition of invention, and then the long, tedious thing of the craft of working the thing out. So I operate on every painting as if it's something where I could go and get a patent for it, and I've often done that.
Yeah, we talked in our first show about your paintings as diagrams, and they really do come across as that in many cases at least. And for people, one more time, I got to tell you to go take a look at some of Paul's work, and you'll get a much better feel for his words at his website. And you can do that at www.laffoley.com, and you can link there from my site over at Mike Hagan as well. All right.
I'm just going to end that part.
Yes,
that has to do with what it means to be transdisciplinary. In other words, there's a thing called multidisciplinary, where the knowledge has an integrity in itself. In other words, it's brought into the same pot, like making mulligan stew or something, where you don't really know what's going to happen. As opposed to when you can actually converge the disciplines to achieve something new when you're doing it. So it's not a stew out at the other end.
Right, I got you. Okay. Hey, you mentioned, I'll take a little bit of a left turn real quick. You said the word Hieronymus, and I thought about Hieronymus Bosch. Were you a fan of his?
Oh, yeah, because, he had alternative ideas about religion. He was part of the Cathars, and which is kind of a modified Gnostic group. Because I've always been interested in Gnosticism.
Sure, the Cathars.
Yeah.
Was he a Dutch? He was from Amsterdam or something, wasn't he?
Well, he actually was English, but his family moved to Holland at some point in their career.
Uh-huh.
So I think that he was or some other parts of his family had gotten information that were not available where he was working, and so that's what because when you look at his things. They look like they look alchemical. They look like medieval symbolic presentations.
Right, they're awesome. They're incredible. Yeah.
And they were the effect of them was a code, and so he was giving out information for people who could translate it. So in a certain sense they. They were very enriched diagrams that diagrammed both something intellectual and something emotional at the same time, recognizing that emotions are things as well as ideas are things, meaning that they are entities that have a closure to them, and so that you can start to work with them. I think it's like if you were to define a fact from the future, you are duty bound to add a sensibility to that. It's like you take like in H.G. Wells, was constantly writing books about the future, and he did a movie, from his book Things to Come. Well, when you see the movie, and you can get it, you can buy it or rent it. And it was done in 1936, and it had most of the advanced imagery that was known at the time. Now, he used a lot of Bauhaus stuff, Lazlo Moholy-Nagy, and guys like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but when he goes into future years, I remember I saw it first in 1973, so 1973 comes up, the thing still looks like 1936. And so at the end, which is supposed to be way in the future, these guys are walking around in 1930s tennis tunics. And so it blows the whole thing because you haven't actually done the job of predicting the new sensibility. And I think that's the reason why you know, people are bored with science fiction because it, you know, the science fiction writers are constantly trying to, you know, make people aware of the future, but they're not doing it because you only get half the job. You get a gadgetry, but you don't get an idea of what it's like to be alive in a time that's alien to yours. I mean, you can't even do it successfully going backwards. You know, like what it's really like to have lived in a medieval period or in ancient Egypt, you know, and,
right.
and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Because they had a different sensibility. So they would that the idea automatically operates on organizing an emotional structure that goes along with showing somebody something new. You know, when somebody uses that phrase, you know, like, or the guy's looking at stuff and he's, well, you can't show me anything new. Then the guy does, and then there's a wallop to it, and it's not because it's an idea that's not understandable. Is it carries with it an authentic new sensibility that the person can't get around. In other words, they can't feel it.
Right.
So they tend to ignore it as fast as they can.
Right.
Yeah.
Boy, yeah, I'm familiar with it. All right, we were talking about alchemy, so before we move along, would you please talk about the stone and what the Philosopher's Stone is, and why it was called that, and you know, you mentioned this liquid, and there's all kinds of different sort of substances that the alchemists were interested in, but talk about the stone, perhaps.
Well, the Philosopher's Stone, that was like something that was had the ability to transform anything into anything else. They thought that it had a physical, a psychological, and a spiritual aspect to it, and so that it would be able to, this is where you get the business of trying to turn lead into gold. So you had to use the Philosopher's Stone to do that, or if you like to upgrade your own mental state, you know, so where you could be smarter than when you started out. You know, and some of these things are starting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember, I think I told you before that I was born with an IQ around 79.
Right.
And then I was placed in a sense in the custody of somebody from Madras, India. You know, he was a Brahmin, who moved it up to 147. And then there was some other things that I got tested really, and now I'm up to 187. So therefore, that if a person thinks that their IQ is stuck, or you have to live with that,
right,
that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, but one thing: if people start doing that, don't go have anything to do with Mensa. They are some of those boring people on the planet. All they talk about is their IQs. You know, and...
I know, what are you going to do with your IQ? You know?
Yeah, well they just sit around. I went to one, because I got in it. I said, I went to one meeting, and I said, I am never coming back. Because it's a form of pride.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of... You know, and then inside of Mensa, they have another... another group, you know, that's more elite, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's totally bogus.
Oh my gosh.
But anyway, the alchemists knew that could happen to people. In other words, so that the Philosopher's Stone would be able to make them smarter when they needed it, and then less smart when they didn't.
Hmm.
Because there are lots of ways to survive, while you're alive.
Right.
And if you just go for one end or the other of intelligence, you're not going to make it. You got to be able to go up and down.
Right. I'm sorry, but I'm just thinking about it. The idea that it was all things to all. In other words, you could it could be anything that you willed, apparently.
Yeah. Well,
if anyone ever did achieve it, wouldn't the world change? Because why would you waste your time making gold? You wouldn't have to then, because you could actually do almost you could do anything, right?
Well, it's very simple, similar to what people have called as black and white holes, because. You know, like a black hole can go through any material thing and screw it up completely, and a white hole can develop any form of energy outward. And so to my mind, that the definition of the Philosopher's Stone keeps changing over time, but I think now a good definition would be it's a black-white hole. So that you could, if you came near it, it would alter your existence dimensionally. Everybody talks about all these dimensions and everything that are around, but what they don't talk about is what are the natural inhabitants of a dimension, and how to portal between one dimension and another.
Mm.
Because I know all the people from string theory. And what they've done is something that's mathematical, or it's like a filing system, and that they said, well, you have to have more dimensions so that the so that the equations will work. That's all they're interested in.
They're
not interested in the fact that if you define people as living in certain dimensions, why is it suddenly stop being relevant to talk about living in other dimensions?
Mm-hmm.
Only it's because that the assumptions that they're holding back are things like that you're going to keep your same intelligence through one dimension and another.
Right.
It isn't going to increase or decrease, or that you will suddenly not have any more senses than you do now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and obviously, from alchemy, you have the insight that when you changed Lucifer, you know, who was the bearer of God's light as absolute revelation, was transformed into Satan. That he, at a certain point in his transformation, he became somebody that had in an infinite number of physical senses, all of which are different than eyes are from ears. Now, we think that you read a science fiction story, somebody goes to another dimension, but they're keeping a lot of the same stuff that's very appropriate to the third and fourth dimension that we feel more familiar with. Now, if you go down to the second dimension of spatiality, in the way that Claude Fayette Bragdon did, you know, becoming a literal shadow. Did we speak about this before?
No, but the two dimensional versus the 3D, is that what we're?
Yes.
Well, I tell you what, we're just about top of the hour. Let's take a short break, okay?
Okay. Yeah, because I get. My throat's gone dry.
Yeah, we've been talking for a long time. We'll take a break here. We'll come back. We get 4 or 5 minutes, and then we can pick up with the shadow, okay?
Okay.
All right, everybody, thanks. We'll be back in just a minute. It's Mike. Yeah. You listen to Radio Orbit. My guest is Paul Laffoley. You can check him out on the web at www.laffoley.com. And he has another website called laffoleyarchive.com. And, of course, at my site, mikehagan.com, you'll be able to link over to Paul's stuff from here on out, and we'll have this program that we're doing right now up in the archives and on the web, on the website tomorrow afternoon, hopefully sometime, probably no later than Wednesday morning. Okay, all right, let's hear one from the Bastard Fairies. This one is called Exoskeleton. It's Mike, you listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia, 89.5 FM.
Nothing left but sin. And that's alright, cause I am an exoskeleton. And it's okay, yes, it's okay, cause in 100 years no one will care. No one will care.
Exoskeleton. It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. And let me say a quick hello to everybody listening this evening. We got things started right off the bat with Paul at the beginning of the program, so we really didn't take the time to say hello. But anyway, hi to everyone who's listening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves or over the web. Thanks for being with us tonight. I hope you're enjoying the program. Having a little bit of trouble with the chat room tonight, so I'm sorry I haven't been able to go in there. We're going to try to do something about that and get a new chat module on the website or something. But at any rate, we'll worry about that another time. In the meantime, we will get back to our guest, Mr. Paul Laughlin. Say hello. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for sticking around.
Okay.
Yeah, and by the way, Paul's out there in Boston, and it is 2 in the morning right now, so I really mean it. Thank you for being up late in the night, Paul.
Well, I usually stay up all night.
Ah, you're a night owl. I know it. I know it. That's pretty. It's funny because there'll be times for the listeners out there. You know, I'll be driving home on a Saturday night after seeing a friend or some music or something like I do, and I pick up the phone and call Paul, and it'll be like middle of the night, and he's right there doing artwork or something. So, anyway, what are you working on these days? You got anything in progress?
Well, I am doing something in an Egyptian motif. It's a commission. It's like the Egyptian flower of life.
Cool.
And, you know, it involves a lot of things, especially the Bestet, the cat goddess, and Thoth, and, you know, in the Valley of the Queens, and, you know, a whole lot of different things.
Hmm.
Again, I think you're going to have to wait and see that on the website, because it would take me 5 hours to describe what I did.
All right. Well, you...
Wait, you wanted me to talk about shadows.
Yeah, let's talk about that again.
Okay, well,
yeah.
that's another part of my Egyptian interest. Because I remember as a kid in Belmont, you know, like, I listened to radio programs, you know, when radio was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always liked the best one was The Shadow.
Hmm.
Because Lamont Cranston, Margot Lane, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And because there was an attempt to describe how you got to be a shadow, but it said he went to the east and learned how to cloud men's minds so they couldn't see him. And I said, well, this isn't a shadow. It's about the invisible man. So although they made an attempt to discuss the structure of this, they didn't actually address the question. So I always wondered if anybody had ever gone to the second dimension of spatiality, which is shadow land.
Uh-huh.
And so I kept thinking about that, and then one day I found out about Claude Fayette Bragdon. He was an architect from Rochester, New York, who did some work in New York City and Central Park and that way. But he was the person that actually did that. And
how so?
Well, he had a wife who was a medium,
as opposed to a large.
Huh? Oh, what?
I'm just kidding.
or an average, right?
Right. Okay.
Well, and anyway, you know, like a trans medium.
Right. Okay.
And she said, you've written books about a primer of higher dimensions and all this kind of stuff, and it influenced Malevich and in suprematism through Uspensky and all these things going on. And she says, but how can you prove this? Because it's really easy to say to people, like, I can go to a higher dimension. How are they going to disprove you?
Right. Okay.
So then she said, well, what if you became a literal shadow? You know, like one of those things, you're walking along and you see a shadow on the wall.
Uh-huh.
And so they got together and thought about this. And when they moved to New York City, they got a room in the Hotel Shelton, which at that time was on Lexington Avenue, behind the place where the Waldorf Astoria would eventually go.
Uh-huh.
Because it had to move from where it was at for the Empire State Building. When they built that, they moved the thing up to about 48th Street on Madison Avenue, or Park Avenue, excuse me, Park Avenue North. And then the next street behind that is Lexington. And there was this, I guess it was a hotel, but people could live there. Like, people that moved there would be like Georgie O'Keefe and Alfred Stieglitz, and people like that were in there. So Claude and his wife, Eugenia, moved there, and she kept bugging him about this. And he said, okay, well, let's try an experiment. So who can we get to be involved in it? And she said, well, we should contact Imhotep. Now Imhotep was the first, Egyptian architect for King Zosar, doing the ziggurats.
The ziggurats, yeah, the pyramids,
kind of
yeah.
And then, but he was also like the grand vizier of Upper and Lower Egypt. I mean, he was the guy that would have like 20 initials after his name, and started that habit that a lot of people have of putting as many initials behind, after their name as they can,
Yeah.
And which is easy to do today. On the, you write in on the computer and you get.
Right,
get a diploma for everything. And so then she said, well, how can we set this up? And he said, well, how about if we borrow the folks' wet plate camera that Stieglitz had with him, because he would be taking pictures of Georgie O'Keefe and different stages of undress and everything. And so he wanted a fine, very fine, grain stuff. In other words, like a wet plate camera is probably a big one, is probably the best way to take a picture. It's the exact opposite of a digital camera.
Mm.
Where you're stuck with all these little pixels.
Right.
Here's it, so that he said, we're going to need something that's very fine-grained to do this experiment. So they, down in the basement, there was a big, almost square room, and so they painted the whole thing all black inside, you know, floor, ceilings, and walls. And then on one wall, they painted, and this was in 1923. So, they imitated like a movie, you know, where you painted a white rectangle on one of the walls. And, they were going to do this right when, when Howard Carter and the Earl of Carnarvon, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, were digging up King Tut. You know, when they opened up the sarcophagus, they had already discovered where it was in the Valley of the Kings, but then they were going to open up the tomb. And so that would be the most propitious moment to do this.
Okay.
And also at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York, they were going to play Aida, which was Claude's favorite opera, and Milton Cross. This was his first day, doing the color for the opera. You know, mm-hmm. He had a long run as describing the operas, and so Eugenia put him in a chair with gynecological stirrups at the back rail of it to hold his two hands up in the air, you know, like in the sign of the car, you know, like it looks like international surrender.
Yeah, yeah.
When you hold your hands up like that.
Uh-huh.
And then she put sticks on the backs of his fingers so that they would stay stiff in an open palm situation.
All right.
And then tied the hands to the chair and the stirrups with red velvet rope or sashing or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then so he's sitting in this chair, and then she puts earphones on his head and has a crystal set with 38 crystals, four more than was on the the ship that sank.
The Titanic?
The Titanic, yeah. Mm-hmm. They're only at 34. So this was like the coolest crystal set ever made. it was amazing. You know, it was a shortwave crystal set, which people think you can't have and everything. And so he's sitting there listening to the opera, you know, in perfect clarity. And then she starts hypnotizing him. And she's saying things like, you will be able to answer me for a while, but not after a while you won't. And then she had lights on the floor, you know, floodlights that were making, like, that made huge hand shadows in the white part of the area behind him.
Right.
And they were just like two big hands up there. And so she keeps talking to him. And he keeps answering back to a point where he can't answer. He's saying things like, I'm experiencing a blackness that I've never known before. And the only way that he could describe it is through a tantric exercise, you know, of separating light from dark, you know, where one of the basic meditations is to take a room, or to think that you're in a room that's completely black, and you're told that inside the room is a sphere of light that's isotropic and homogeneous throughout its extension, so that as you enter the room you can't see anything, nothing's reflecting until your retina actually penetrates this sphere of light. And then so you have a complete distinction. So the blackness that is in there, which you can't see, even when you turn all your lights out, there's still some photons floating around in there, so that you don't get this. You have to do it in your mind, you know, to be able to separate light from dark that way. And so here was the situation where he's now experiencing one half of this exercise, she could tell that he was getting scared, you know, like his body was starting to writhe, you know, like he was going into an epileptic fit.
Uh-huh.
And so then she was taking pictures with this folks wet plate camera of the whole procedure. And lo and behold, in between the fingers and the thumb, little protrusions in the shadow started to occur, you know, which sort of looked like Egyptian hieroglyphics first, and then they changed into into Latin or in English letters, you know, the way we write letters.
Right, and the letters were on the palm, or
it was at. In other words, say like if you look at the shadow,
uh-huh,
and you see the fingers,
right,
and that it comes out in between.
Wow. Right.
So the shadow is completely black.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't on anything. In other words, it made distortions in the shapes of the fingers. And finally, it was like letters that said, "Help! Help! Get me out of this thing!" You know, so that it was apparently an extremely scary thing.
Huh.
And so this was, and actually, I think the closest that anybody's ever come to actually being a shadow. Now, that became an amazing buzz in the art world,
uh-huh,
you know, in the 20s, and of course in the 30s it started the radio program The Shadow. But they didn't talk about how this started, because first of all they didn't know what would happen after a while, so that in order to make it commercially viable, you know, they had to just go for something that made Lamont Cranston become a shadow.
Right.
But really, what it was describing somebody who was invisible.
Huh.
And you know, to cause a person to become an actual shadow, because the Egyptians believed that there were nine parts of the personality, and the kaibat, which is what they call the shadow of the body, had as much right to be part of the personality as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all rules about not stepping on it, you know, and then, you know, what happens when they melded with other shadows, and,
huh,
you know, and this kind of stuff. And of course, like, if you look at their art, they use shadows as a way to outline anything, you know, when they, you know, most of the figures are one-sided, you know, where you tend to see the legs and the arms and you know, all laid out. In other words, a non-three-dimensional way to draw something.
Mm, mm-hmm.
You know, and they developed that completely. So okay, that I think that they were literally masters of becoming shadows.
Huh, fascinating.
And it could have been a survival mechanism, because, like, the desert is hotter than hell.
Right.
So that you know, where you try to go into the shadow to get cooled off, or that way, and so this was a way that you could do it with your own body.
How much of this, you know, we've been talking about alchemy and now this sort of thing. Let's talk about the psyche and its role in this, because it seems like the mind is basically capable of anything, because it's transmuting matter and spirit,
right,
and changing us
to
shadows and shapes.
But what stops it from doing anything are the assumptions that people make about it.
So in other words, we're much more limited by cultural rules and convention than we are by the actual physical laws and this sort of thing.
Well, more. I mean, in any time you set up a law, you've then limited what mind stuff is, and so that. It's hard to break through, and the reason why that it changes so slowly over history is because of what DNA does. In other words, that we're programmed to survive, We're programmed to survive in the same way that cancer cells survive. If we were able to transmute all our bodily cells all into cancer at the same time and then keep some new form of intercellular communication system, we would never die.
Right, we would be immune to cancer because we would be it. Yeah.
Because the cancer cells eat anything that's around it. And the reason why they die is they run out of a host.
Right.
You know, and so that there's got to be something else going on here. So I'm saying that when you have definitions of what limits what mentality is all about or what consciousness is,
right,
then you start to get a culture. So we always, like people say, you have to work from your limits. And so changing limits is probably the last thing a person does in life, not the first thing.
One of my old friends used to say, culture is not your friend.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. In other words, it's not friendly to something that wants to be able to do everything. Mm. At the same time, because in other words, like the image of time is that you can't do everything all at once.
Mm. Yeah, linear or sequential, right?
Yeah.
What happens when that goes haywire? I mean, what would happen if you could experience more than one thing? I mean, I guess we do all the time.
Well, you have the time machine.
Yeah, I mean,
to me,
is that the end of history?
I have said that, but I think that's probably, you know, more dramatic than real, because I think that say everything literally is history, so that you can't in a sense get away from it.
Right.
But the idea of time is a back to back, non-reversible set of events that is a cause and an effect and an abyss of transition between the cause and the effect, so you can connect to eternity at durance and that sort of thing. That those things, to me, dimensional, I mean, more dimensions of temporality help to eliminate a lot of the sense of given restrictions that you have, and you can develop more things, considering that. That's why I've done a complete dimensional system of both spatiality and temporality, because I think the interaction of those things are not as simplistic as Einstein and Minkowski said, or some of the other people that have added some dimensions, and then the ones that are in string theory that are adding dimensions now, as I said before, they're really trying to fill out a file cabinet to make mathematics work,
right,
and not pay attention to the existential conditions of what it means to be within the dimension or without of it, and then climbing from one or going down from another.
Mm.
I think that's what I was trying to talk about with Claude Fayette Bragdon. And I was trying to become a shadow rather than, I remember I had this argument with Fuller, because he was saying that a shadow is just simply the absence of light, and it had no other significance than that. Now that's similar to the way that Isaac Newton, talked about light. Which is really amazing, because he was one of the prime alchemists of his time.
Yeah.
And I think that his books were set up so that the people that came after him, who turned into reductive scientists, were redefining his books to help their position. And not what he was doing, because he would throw away a lot of stuff that people could live off of, as a scientist
right.
today, if they had those ideas. Right.
Who do you think was the last practicing or successful, maybe is a better way to put it, alchemist? Or do you think there ever has been one?
Oh, no. I think that it depends upon what you're trying to achieve.
Right.
You know, so in other
how
words,
do you define
as
success?
Alchemy has physical, psychological, and spiritual goals. Now the goals can be combined together or operated on separately.
Mm-hmm.
And so the minute you set up different goals, then you're going to have a lot of tracking, you know, different kinds of people. And I think that the people who are involved in psychotronics now are the actual heirs to the whole tradition of alchemy.
Hmm, interesting.
Because they're doing those things. I said, like Robert Pavlita lived on Alchemy Row in Prague, Czechoslovakia,
mm-hmm.
and that's where most of it was going on in the Middle Ages, and it spread out, you know, from there. So there was an actual headquarters, you can't call them experiments because they were more like the way scientists will talk about thought experiments today.
Hmm.
You know, where you actually don't have to do anything physical to get the information. And so the Gedanken Experimente, you know, the German word for thought experiment.
Right.
Like apes Aristotle in the way he thought about physics, but actually passes through a phase of just rote experiment, you know, where you just keep repeating something till you find something new out of it, but mindlessly, like a machine operating in a laboratory, so that you have another type of situation. So who it is as a person that's doing that, I think there's a lot of people.
Hmm.
And they're all over the place around the earth now. And there's a lot in England. There's obviously, some in Paris and France. Because you find really good occult bookstores in Paris. I remember when I first got into this, like I had to go to Paris to find things
that I couldn't find anywhere else.
So you go to the public library, the Boston Public Library, all the books on the occult were stolen.
Because
people knew that something was up.
Right. You know? Do you recall a book that was called The Mystery of the Cathedrals that was written by someone who went by the name of Fulcanelli?
Yes.
What did you make? Do you have any opinion on that? I mean, just as a side note, only because I have a guy who's been on the program once or twice who's very interested in this character, Fulcanelli, and what he may have had to say with regard to the secrets of alchemy and how they were encoded in the cathedral architecture and all this sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, like Francis Yates, who wrote about the art of memory, talked about all that kind of stuff. In other words, this is before it was a pre-literate way to hold information.
Hmm.
You know,
books in stone, right? They call them.
Yeah, where you would of course the cathedral was the educational system of the time. It was like consulting the internet.
Hmm.
I mean, it had all the stuff that a person needed to know, so you didn't. That was going to school every Sunday, you know.
Right, right.
But what I was talking about is I lost the track. What was the question again?
Well, Fulcanelli.
In the art of memory. In other words, in a pre-literate world, how did you hold an enormous amount of information in your mind?
Right.
How would a lawyer plead a case? Well, in the buildings that they would be so designed that it made it easy for people to do things like, you know, one column represented some ideas for the defense and the other for the plaintiff, you know, and then summations in areas so that when they would come into they would come into the courtroom, they had previously set up their whole case so they could rattle the things off. And
it was all done with symbols.
Well, it was done by using parts of the structure.
Right.
So when you looked at that's why I think that you have you had very complicated buildings, before the modern world. The modern world has uncomplicated buildings. You have smooth walls.
Right.
You have like factories where people who worked in the factories, because the machine age style is all the imagery of factories.
Yeah, it's basically boxes. I mean,
yeah. So the people are working like slaves. So they're not thinking about anything. They're just mindlessly doing an activity. So that nothing in it would cause them to stop and contemplate something, you know, or set up in any of these memory systems. So but you know, like even in the 19th century, like a shingle style house that has an amazing number of spaces in it. Now that made it possible for somebody to, in a sense, live in one place their whole life and never get bored. Because, you know, today, what people complain about most is being bored. And so it's due to the architecture that we have. In other words, if we have like living in smoothies and boxes and file cabinets and things like that, because you can't apply anything to it. So the idea of ornament was eliminated. You know, where ornaments were often ways that captured your mind immediately, so that you were able to remember things.
Right.
And that's why Louis Sullivan's architecture is so unbelievable. When you see it, you can't believe the ornament that guy came up with. So those are all his thoughts placed in that building.
Right. Remarkable. All right. Up to you. We can take a short break, or we can continue. Up to you.
Well, let me get my throat back in shape.
Yeah, we'll do about a 3-minute break, okay?
Okay, good.
And then we'll come on back with Paul,
yep.
And then we'll have about 15 or 20 or so, okay?
All right,
everybody, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We're on the line here with Mr. Paul Laffley, a wonderful architect and artist, talking to us live from his studio in Boston, Massachusetts, and covering all kinds of interesting topics tonight. And we'll get back with him in just a minute. In the meantime, this one is called Ode to the Prostitute. Back in just a minute. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Illustrated, detailed course in perversion, abnormal sex, crime and violence. It is also a fact that no matter who buys this material, 75 to 90% of it ends up in the hands of our children.
Everybody, hello, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Get right back to Mr. Paul Laffley here. I have a couple of questions that came up, Paul, while we were on the break there. And I want to ask you about mythology, but I don't want to do it quite yet. But I just want you to know that, that's something that I want to talk about after this. But I've had a little trouble with the website, but I did get a chance to grab a question from someone there who says, please ask Paul why he places the Olipoth in his painting of the Kabbalistic Sephira of Da'ath.
All right.
Now, I'm not, I'm just reading this from the website. Hopefully this was an accurate.
Okay. Well, that was, like, Da'ath is the Sephira that connects to the next higher or the next lower set of ten. In other words, in the Kabbalistic worldview, that there are 40 concentric spheres, you know, like looking at an onion, and that so those are things that are like the suits in the tarot, you know, where you have you know like the four sets of tens and then the 22 letters of the major arcana, you know, are make that funny triangular shape. You know, we have Kether at the top and Malkuth at the bottom.
Right,
this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it looks almost like a Bucky thing or something,
right.
Or like a molecular thing. I always said it looked like a molecular thing too.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and also like a Frank Lloyd Wright plan.
That's cool. I love that.
I did make a farm in that form, so that's actually ready to go. You know, it has a whole lot of things, and then surrounding it is a labyrinth of gnosis, you know, made out of hedgerows and stuff.
Cool.
Okay, but anyway, what was the question again?
He just asked why you placed the Olipoth in that particular painting of the Kabbalistic Sephira.
Well, because that's a condition that you have to get away from demons at that point, because this is like the Kabbalah at that degree of study utilized something that was Satan was an adversary. So the part of the idea was, if you had demons, what they were doing is trying to prevent you from getting to a higher level, so that you were really worthy of it and you were able to do it.
So if you failed and
didn't get through, that was your fault, not because like the demons were almost like a mechanical stopgap in the situation, because like you could take the first tree and you lay that down, and then you take Molkoth and then put that on top of Da'ath, And then you've got another one, and then you do that one, two, three, four, and then you have a rise of it, so that you've taken it two-dimensionally, so something that's actually like a hypersphere, a fourth-dimensional sphere, which has all those things inside of it, till you get up to the Ain and the Ain Sof and the Ain Sofer out at the edge, which is very similar to like Dante, talking about the prime and mobile, and then God on the outside and
right.
the celestial
right.
row. So they,
right.
all those things work together. But in the Kabbalah, it's like what's there to prevent you from going, right to the top, and that's why they always said that you have to be 40 years old before you start learning it, because you're not going to recognize that it's not mechanical, it's not like a mathematical thing, that you have to go through the ferocity of the emotional trauma to get to higher levels.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of like a governor that's in place that you sort of have to be able. What was it? I remember Joseph Campbell, and I wanted to ask you about mythology, but I remember Joseph Campbell used to talk about how the hero in the hero stories was always ready for the task that awaited him or her,
mm-hmm.
and so it was sort of a trial by fire sort of a situation.
Yeah, because people look at things that. As if there's nothing going on, like you can describe something, but that doesn't give you any of the actual effect of going through it.
Right, the experience.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, how does mythology play into this whole thing? And are we writing a new mythology? Are we making new mythology? Do we require new mythology? New stories? Stories sufficient?
Yeah. Okay. But the concept of mythology is a put down on other people's religions. Like in college, I used to know this guy that was like preached agnosticism all the time, and he called that because I was a believing Catholic, that I was practicing modern mythology. That's what's actually in most people's minds. Like Joseph Campbell trying to elevate it as a concept, mainly because what he was doing was relating it to people's current experiences and showing there was something going on. But to have to do that, it was the problem. In other words, it should be obvious
right.
to people that there have been spiritual practices since the beginning of time, and you don't have to elevate them or make them better than they are, because they're the best they can be at any time, and people should be able to recognize it. So what it says to us is that we have a non-sacred culture. And like people who talk about the future of religion are talking about how to take the mysticism out of it, the heart of it.
It's already been done, hasn't it?
Yeah. But the thing is that a myth, to my mind, I mean, as a technical word, is actually the same thing as a symbol. In other words, and it occurs for us between the fourth and the fifth dimensional realm. And so to go from one of those, you have to go through an authentic symbol. Like a symbol can be described as in an epistemic ladder, where you have a sign, an index, an icon, an archetype, and a symbol. And what's going on is that you are going from arbitrary information to one where it's totally non-arbitrary, meaning that when you know something that's information by convention, you go from one position to another, and your desire to know is never satisfied, and so you start to get into an index, like forensic medicines. tracks in the snow, you know that something's there, and an icon is you start to be able to picture what it is you're after, and then an archetype is like what Jung was talking about, something that shows up around the earth to different people as the same thing, but they don't know each other, so they don't know how they got that, until finally you come to a real symbol where you've inversed the epistemic model. So the knower and that which is known, which starts out where the knower is active and the knowledge is passive. Now, in the case of the symbol, it's the knower is passive and the knowledge is active, meaning that you could actually be in the presence of a symbol, and something outside of the whole situation has to knock you out of the relationship. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So that the same thing happens in temporality, so that you go through a myth in the same way. So that I would say I think I've tried to raise the concept of myth to its higher form or its highest form, because you can go to something beyond myth and beyond the symbol, you know, between the fifth and sixth dimensional realm, and so it would have a completely new definition that we can't experience without something really radically happening to us.
Do you think that there's obviously evolutionary change is always happening, but do you think that it's happening quick enough that we're actually going to see something happen, you know, in our lifetimes where there may actually be in other words, I always think that looking at the global culture, that something radical is going to have to happen in order to shift this train off into a different direction.
But I think that it's unfortunate that we use the word evolution, because that was an invention of Darwin,
right,
describing biological and entities and how they interacted and how they were placed in phylum and species and this kind of stuff, and we've used the word where we need another word. That's what I think is the whole problem of the contest between evolutionists and creationists, is that the creationists are taking like a fundamentalist Christian position, but what they're actually doing is saying that there has to be something that has to do with stuff that's spiritual, because you can reduce and eliminate almost anything by using the traditional notion of evolution. I don't use it myself. I'm not a creationist, you know, in that way, because I deal with all kinds of religions.
Sure.
So we don't have enough nomenclature. I think that's in the same way there isn't enough nomenclature to describe higher and lower dimensions of temporality. We don't have nomenclature for the realm of the spirit that has anything that's other than very vague connections to stuff that we experience on the physical level.
So we're in a linguistic box?
Sure.
If you can't describe it, you can't go there.
Well, it's like in the Kabbalah. In other words, a word is a thing, and a thing is a word. And so language, it becomes very, very important. So the people say, well, it's just words. No, those things are the identification of a word with the thing and the thing with the word becomes the most important clue as to how to get out of that box. In other words, I think that's how you hook historicism to the whole thing. That language becomes more and more important, not less important.
Right.
Because
right.
Language carries with it all kinds of emotional baggage that should be there. It's that, you know, when you go on a trip, you have to bring baggage,
right?
And so that you so to assume that that's impedimentia that you get rid of when you're traveling. No, not true. I mean, you may eliminate a few things, but you find what's actually necessary for the next stage. You got to bring some stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so that I think that we don't have enough actual language. Like Stan Tenen has done very, very amazing things with Hebrew, you know, in how those letters have meaning. Like you can take a spiral and put it in the tetrahedron, you know, like this, the flame in the tent,
mm-hmm.
and you can aim lights in 22 directions, and you can get all the glyphs of the Hebrew alphabet. So you've got something that has there's a oneness about that, but it's the one that goes into multiplicity.
Right, this whole hyperdimensional thing.
Yeah.
And that is intense.
Right, and it's like, I've known him for like a long while now, all the time people are ripping this guy off. It's incredible.
Right.
You know, but the thing is that he's dealing with things like letters as they are things.
Mm-hmm.
So the symbolhoodness of them starts to appear once you see the matrix that they produce.
Amazing. All righty. Well, look, Paul, I think it's time to wrap it up, as we say,
okay.
In the biz. And I know you're getting a little bit tired in the voice there as well. So I have to thank you, as always. It's been a pleasure, man. And I could talk to you for hours, and we'll have to get together again in a few months and maybe do it again. We got plenty more
sure.
to talk about, okay? Because I really think this idea of how we're going to move into the future is one that people need to be talking about, because the message essentially from that's being peddled out there in the mainstream media is essentially that the future is a five-alarm fire. You know, and I think we have to have some better rhetoric.
They're just using an apocalypse image,
right?
You know, like that's how they've been interpreted in Nostradamus.
Mm.
You know, like every one of those interpretations is some kind of disaster,
right?
And so why can't there be non-disastrous presentations of the future? I mean, you know, that it's because people want to end stuff. And that's so they're on a death trip, I think, as opposed to a life. So what about a future where you increase life?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm interested to, and I appreciate you bringing that stuff forward, Paul. All right.
Okay.
All right, everybody. Thanks very much. One more time to Paul Laffley. Paul, we'll talk to you later.
Oh, wait a minute. Just before we go,
yes.
Has anybody discovered how I can get a hold of Elvis Hitler?
Oh, I'm sure it's out there, but I it's probably waiting in my email, but I promise I'll get it to you in the next day or two, okay?
All right.
All right. Take care of yourself, Paul, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot.
All right, everybody. That's Paul Laffley. You can find out information about Paul on the web at laffley.com. This is Mike Hagan. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Stick around for Crash Landing with Ruth in just a few minutes. We'll have Elaine Matthews with us next week. She's a wonderful woman, wrote a great book called The Heart of Intelligence. We'll speak with her and have some different music next week. All right? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. And this is one last one from the Bastard Fairies on the web at thebastardfairies.com. You can also connect with them through my website at MikeHagan, HAGAN.com. And KOPN always streaming it out at KOPN.org.
Big. Tomorrow you might be dead.